So thank you for coming for this third lecture in this series. I have to apologize for my voice. I can't speak very loudly, even with a microphone, so... Now the topic today is Bhagavatam cosmology and modern astronomy. Of course, this is one of the more difficult topics. It's not very easy to say things about the Bhagavatam cosmology of the fifth canto. So I'm just going to pray to Srila Prabhupada that I can say a few words and not make any big mistakes. So the Vedic cosmology as described in Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic literature such as Brahma Samhita is different than the modern materialistic cosmology. It contains a spiritual aspect. According to the Vedic cosmology, the material realm is only part of the complete whole. The material realm only occupies a small corner of the spiritual sky, which is full of spiritual Vaikuntha planets, and the topmost of which is Goloka Vrindavan, Krishna's abode. So in the material sky, Krishna expands as the Mahavishnu, and from the Mahavishnu many material universes emanate. And Mahavishnu enters into each universe as the Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. And from the lotus flower that comes from the Garbhadakshayi Vishnu, Brahma takes birth, the chief demigod who's the engineer of the universe, responsible for organizing the planetary systems and making the bodies for the conditioned souls that will inhabit each universe. And then there's a further expansion of Mahavishnu as the super soul, who enters into the hearts of all living things and into each atom. Now, each of these material universes has a shell, which is composed of layers of different elements, each one 10 times bigger than the rest. I'm not showing this to scale, otherwise it would be really too big. And in in different parts of the Bhagavatam, the shells are listed slightly differently. But this is one of the orders of the shells. In this particular order, the outer layer is ego. Some places it's Mahatattva. Then within that, there's a shell of mind. Within that, there's a shell of ether. Within that, there's a shell of air. Within that, there's a shell of fire. Within that, there's a shell of water. Within that, there's a shell of earth. And then And then there's the interior part of the universe, and that's the part that we inhabit. Now the universes are of different sizes, but the universe that we inhabit, and the universe that we inhabit, the interior part within the shells, has a diameter of 500,000 yojanas. And if we take it that a yojana is 8 miles, the diameter of the interior part is about 4 billion miles. In the very center are the dwipas and oceans. There's 7 ring islands and 7 ring oceans. But they occupy only the very center. On the outermost island, there's Manasatara Mountain, which the sun travels around. And then you go out from there and you come to Loka Loka Mountain. And the Bhagavatam says that the light of the sun and the other luminaries goes out to Loka Loka Mountain. And then beyond that, there's a dark region that goes out to the shell of the universe. You know, so that's the basic geography or basic structure of the interior of the universe according to Srimad Bhagavatam. If we look at the ring islands and oceans, you know, we see they start out with Jambudweep, then there's a saltwater ocean, then Plakshadweep, Sugarcane Ocean, Shamali Dweep, then a Liquor Ocean, then Kusha Dweep, and a Ghee Ocean, then Krancha Dweep, and a Milk Ocean, then Shaka Dweep, and a Yogurt Ocean, then Pushkara Dweep, and a Freshwater Ocean. It's in the middle of Pushkara Dweep that the Manasatara Mountain runs. And the sun, you know, travels, you know, the sun god travels along that mountain in his chariot. And there's an interesting temple at Konark in Orissa, which is actually a huge model of the sun chariot, the sun god. How many have been there? You've been to Konark. Some of you have been. And they have some of the horses there that were pulling the chariot. And, you know, they have the wheels of the chariot. And everything has a very detailed, you know, astronomical significance. I mean, whole books have been written, you know, about all the cosmological details. And then there are a few statues, images of the sun god there at the different times of day, representing the different times of day. So the sun runs along the top of the Manasatara Mountain, which rises from Bhumandala, the plane of the Earth planetary system. And then beyond that, there's the moon, Soma or Chandra, Venus or Shukra, Mercury or Buddha, Mars, Mangala, Jupiter, Brihaspati, Saturn, Sainashchara. So this is all and these are the ring islands of oceans out here. At the very center, there's Junggu-dweep. You're surrounded by the ocean of salt water. In the middle of Junggu-dweep is Mount Sumeru, on top of which is the city of Brahma and the demigods. This is it's called Junggu-dweep because there's a jumbo tree there. This is a jumbo tree. This is jumbo fruit, if you're ever wondering. How many have had jumbo fruit? You have, okay. Some of you have. So it's residents of Junggu-dweep. We should know these things. It's interesting that many Vedic temples are models of this cosmographical structure. For example, the Angkor Wat temple in Cambodia is like a model of Junggu-dweep with the central part of the temple representing Mount Meru, and then there's four other towers, representing the four mountains that surround Mount Meru. And you can see it nicely from the top, where you have the central tower, the four other towers, and then the the rings, that represent dweepas and oceans. So all of this is somewhat different in many respects from the picture we get from modern astronomy, with its version of the solar system and its picture of outer space full of galaxies. So we have to ask ourselves, why is there this difference? And my best understanding from Guru Shastra and Sadhu is that it's because of a difference in sensory power, a difference in the ability to perceive what's actually there. Today's scientists, with their senses and their instruments, are able to perceive a certain aspect of reality, but they're not able to perceive the entire reality. For example, a great personality like Srila Vyasadeva, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, with his spiritual senses, may perceive things that astronomers cannot perceive very completely with their senses and instruments. And we also see that in order to see the universal form, Arjuna had to have divine eyes. He couldn't see the universal form with his ordinary vision. Krishna had to give him divine vision, and then he could see the reality of the universal form. The same with Mother Yashoda. Krishna at one point revealed this universal form to her, and then she became bewildered, and then it said that Krishna withdrew it, and she returned to her normal state, able to perceive Krishna as her child again. So, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we were introduced to the idea that there are different levels of sensory perception. And on one level of sensory perception, you may be able to perceive things that you can't perceive on other levels. So I think that's one thing that we have to take into account when we try to understand why the vision of modern astronomers is different than the vision of Vyasadeva or Shukadeva Goswami. And just even here in Vrindavan, we can understand that an ordinary person coming to Vrindavan will perceive it in one way, and those with advanced spiritual capabilities will perceive it in a different way. And there's some interesting modifications of time and space in the Vedic or Bhagavatam cosmology. For example, we're here in Vrindavan now, and we can drive across it or walk across it. It seems to be a certain dimension. But here we read this statement from Srila Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrita. According to the revelations of revealed scripture, Vrindavan extends only 16 kroshas, 32 miles. Nonetheless, all the Vaikuntha planets and innumerable universes are located in one corner of this tract. So, our perception of the dimensions of this place may be a little bit restricted. We're not able to perceive the entire dimension of this dham. There's some other interesting modifications of the spatial dimension that are described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. For example, once the Lord Brahma of our universe went to visit Krishna in Dwarka, and he went to the gateway of the door of Krishna's palace and knocked there, and the doorman, Krishna's doorman, answered and said, well, what can I do for you? And he said, I'm Brahma. I'd like to speak to Lord Krishna. So the doorman went back to Lord Krishna and said, Lord Brahma's here to see you. And Krishna sent the doorman back to ask him, which Brahma? And so Dharma went back and said, his lordship inquires, which Brahma are you? And Brahma was stunned because he hadn't realized there were other Brahmas. So then Krishna managed to bring, by Krishna's transcendental potency, he brought all the Brahmas from all the different universes there to Dwarka. And you see they have different numbers of heads according to the size of the universe over which they have dominion. But it's actually interesting because although our Brahma could see all of these other Brahmas there, each of the other Brahmas thought he was still in his own universe and that Krishna had come and was speaking only with him. Now you try to wrap your mind around that. It's like, what's going on there? It's like many different things are happening at once in a way that kind of defies our logic and reason and normal types of perception. Because Krishna was present with each Brahma individually, but our Brahma was seeing them all together. So the Bhagavatam cosmology includes some very radical kind of shifts in time and space. If you look at the story of Vamana, the incarnation of Krishna who appeared to Bali Maharaj, again we see some interesting modifications of the spatial dimension. We know the story. King Bali asked Vamana, who was appearing as a dwarf Brahmin boy, to request anything he desired. And Vamana just said, I want 3 steps of land. And the king thought, oh, King Bali thought, oh, well, that's nothing. You know, why just three steps? But it turned out that his steps, his first step, you know, he covered, you know, the entire earth, and the second step, the entire universe. And then with the third step, you know, there was no place for his third step, so the king said, put it on my head. So, what is a step? For us, a step is, you know, a few feet, but for Vamana, his step could cover the entire universe. Even though, you know, he was appearing as a small boy. Then there's some distortions of the time dimension. There's the story of King Kukudmi, you know, who was looking for a husband for his daughter, Remati. And he decided to go with his daughter to Brahmaloka to inquire from Brahma about the different husbands he was considering. So Kukudmi and Remati arrived in Brahmaloka. They had to wait a little while because Brahma was attending a concert, and after a few moments, Brahma came out and said, what can I do for you? And the king began to explain, well, I'm considering so many possibilities for a husband for my daughter. I'm considering this king or that king. And Brahma began to laugh. He said, in the short time you've been here, millions of years have passed on earth, and all these kings that you're talking about have disappeared from people's memory. He said, but it's okay, when you go back, it'll be time for Balaram to appear, and your daughter can have him as her husband. So the Bhagavatam cosmology involves different levels of perception, different modifications of time and space as we understand them. Now, even just in terms of ordinary material science, astronomers will perceive the universe differently according to the type of instrument that they use. On the right, you see a certain section of the sky as it looks through the Hubble optical telescope. And then on the left, you see the same region of the sky as it looks through the Chandra. Interesting, they named, probably there were some Indian scientists involved in making that satellite. It's an X-ray telescope satellite called Chandra. And through that telescope, which is looking at the X-ray part of the spectrum, you see entirely different structures than you see with the optical telescope. So even according to just ordinary science, the universe looks differently according to the kind of instrument that you view it with. Certain structures will be visible through one instrument that aren't visible through another. So I think in the same way, there are different levels of sensory perception and different structures of the Bhagavatam universe are going to be visible or not visible according to the level of sensory perception. So senses are like instruments. So according to the instrument, certain features will be revealed or not revealed. So one question that always seems to come up in a discussion like this is, what about the sun and the moon? Is the moon further away than the sun? Now, for the discussion that follows, you know, I indebted to Sataputta Prabhu for, you know, work that he did in his book Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. Now, Srila Prabhupada said the moon is further away than the sun. And he also said this. He said, if these boys, in their scientific language, he's talking about the Bhaktivedanta Institute scientists, said, if these boys, in their scientific language, if they try to convince, that will be more effective. We are generally speaking that water has come from Krishna or the earth has come from Krishna. That may be blind. But if it is scientifically presented how it has come from Krishna, then they cannot refute so easily. So here, Srila Prabhupada's asking his scientifically trained devotees to explain things that he has said in some simple way, in a scientific way, that's not so easy to refute. So this was a service, you know, that Srila Prabhupada gave his scientifically trained devotees to translate certain things that he said in some simple way that may seem blind, and to put it into scientific terms that aren't so easy to refute. So let's see how we might do that. Here again, you know, we have the Bhagavatam, you know, picture of the positions of, you know, the sun and the different planets. And it appears different from the picture of the solar system that modern astronomers see. But we have to go back to this idea that there are different modes of perception. And according to the mode of perception or the instrument of perception, things might appear differently. But still, even though this appears different from this, there's still some connection between the two. It's not that they're two completely different things. It's the same with, you know, our vision of Vrindavan. This is different from this, but there's some connection between the two. Otherwise, if there weren't a connection between the two, it wouldn't serve any purpose for us to be here. There is a connection between the Vrindavan that we may see with our limited senses and the more spiritual perception of Vrindavan. And it's possible to understand to some degree, you know, what the connections are. And just like some of the Goswamis and their followers would identify, you know, places that we can see as the place where Krishna did this, or the place where Krishna and the gopis did that, or the place where Lalita did that, or Vishakha did that. So there's some connection between the two visions. They're not entirely separate. So in the same way, there is some connection, you know, between the Bhagavatam cosmology and the picture of the solar system that modern astronomers see. And let's see if we can find out, you know, what the connection is, what the connecting link is. The key, I think, lies here on Pushkar Dweep on the Manasatara Mountain. So the Bhagavatam says that the sun travels around this circular mountain all the way around once in 360 days a year, according to the Vedic calendar. So that corresponds to something that the modern astronomers observe. It's the path of the sun through the zodiac. The path that the sun follows through all the different constellations of the zodiac. You know, Cancer, Capricorn, all those. That's called the ecliptic. And the sun passes through that cycle once a year. You know, 360 days. We would say 365 days, but same thing. So there's a connection between the Bhagavatam cosmology and modern astronomy. Here's just another version of the same thing. This blue portion here represents the Earth's equatorial plane. Like if you extended a plane out from the equator of the Earth, it would extend like this. Now we see that the ecliptic goes at an angle of 23.5 degrees from the equatorial plane of the Earth. like that. So you see that angle there. That's very important. The equatorial plane of the Earth, the ecliptic, an angle of 23.5 degrees. Now the moon also has a path that it follows through the stars. It goes through the nakshatras, as they're called in the Vedic. But it has its own path that goes through the stars. And if we look at the path, the circular path that the moon follows through the stars, we see it's not exactly the same as the sun's path. Here's the sun's path through the zodiac. It rises at an angle of about 23.5 degrees above the Earth's equatorial plane. So everybody sees that, yes? Does everybody understand that? Okay, the moon's orbit, the moon's path through the stars, goes up higher than that. It rises an additional, 5 degrees above the orbit of the sun. So does everybody understand that? So you can see the order of the orbits is Earth, Sun, Moon. The orbit of the Moon rises higher above the equatorial plane of the Earth than that of the Sun. So let's go back to the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam, in the section that is describing the positions of the planets, is not describing line of sight distance. It's describing the position of the orbits. The sun is orbiting around Mount Meru on the top of Manasatara Mountain, going around in a circle. The sun's orbit, according to the Bhagavatam, is higher than that. So, in the Bhagavatam, you have Earth plane, Sun, Moon. In modern astronomy, you have Earth's equatorial plane, orbit of Sun, orbit of Moon. Yes. Technically here it would be the declination of the orbits. it's not a perfect match, but it shows, you know, if we consider very carefully the connections and we carefully understand, you know, what, you know, the Bhagavatam was talking about, then we can offer an explanation that's not very easy to refute, which is what Srila Prabhupada said, you know, should be done. In this statement. If these boys in their scientific language, they try to convince, that would be more effective. Yeah, we are generally speaking that water has come from Krishna, or the earth has come from Krishna, or, you know, moon is farther than the sun, or whatever. That may be blind, but if it's scientifically presented, how it has come from Krishna, then they, the material scientists, can't refute so easily. So I'm proposing this as a way to fulfill, you know, Srila Prabhupada's instruction that these things be presented in a scientific way that isn't very easy to refute. Now, I will say it's up to you whether you want to accept that explanation or not. We can't disagree about what the Bhagavatam says, how, you know, Jhutakarma presents what it says. You can agree with or disagree with. But I think this is one way, one very good way that I have found to explain this statement, the moon is further away than the sun from the earth. So, does everybody understand what I said? I'm not asking whether you agree with it or not, but everybody, does anybody have any question about that? Is that clear, what I'm trying to say there?
I know somebody has a question.
Okay. So, because then I would ask you, next time somebody asks you this question, try to explain it like this and see if you can do it. You can find this explanation in one of Sariputta's books. It's not so easy to understand. I've tried to unpack it a little bit so it's easier to understand here. Now, another interesting thing is all the planets have their orbits. You know, if you look at night, I mean, that's what I'm saying, oh, the Saturn is in this constellation, or, you know, Jupiter is here, because each planet has its orbit that it follows through the stars. So, according to modern astronomy, okay, you have the Earth's equatorial plane, then there's the orbit of the Sun, the ecliptic, then there's the Moon's orbit, then the next orbit higher up is the orbit of Venus, and then comes the orbit of Mercury, then the orbit of Mars, the orbit of Jupiter, and the orbit of Saturn. So you notice this isn't the order of the planets from the Sun. It's a completely different order in some parts. You've got Sun, Moon, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in terms of the orbital declination. You know, above the Earth's equatorial plane. Now, interestingly enough, that is also the order of the planets given in the Bhagavatam. Sun, Moon, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Sun, Moon, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. So, if we carefully study the matter, we can see some very interesting connections between the vision of the Bhagavatam and the vision of the modern materialistic astronomers. So, another question that comes up in a discussion like this. did the astronauts go to the moon? So, actually, Srila Prabhupada said three different things. So I think we have our choice, you know, as devotees, as followers of our founder Acharya, if we're members of ISKCON, we have three choices to pick from. One thing that Srila Prabhupada said was they never went. It was all a hoax, sort of signified by this movie stage, you know, Hollywood stage, you know, with filming, you know, the astronauts on the moon. Pushta Krishna. But now Prabhupada, they say that they have been to the moon and they have their pictures also to prove it. Prabhupada, picture you can manufacture here. So, that's one choice. Another thing that Srila Prabhupada said was they went, but they were turned back by the demigods' passport control. Couldn't get into the country. Prabhupada, you have to qualify yourself for getting visa of entrance into Moon Planet. Reporter, what I'm saying is that if astronauts were able to land and return to the Earth, Prabhupada, if I go in New York border and see and come back, and I am not allowed to enter, why should I take so much trouble? It is useless trouble. And he repeated this kind of thing several times. This is just one, you know, statement that he made like this, that yes, they went, but they couldn't stay there. They couldn't enter into the realm of the demigods. They had to go back. So, another thing he said was the demigods diverted the astronauts to some uninhabited region of the moon, or perhaps some other planet, he sometimes said. An example of a statement like that. If moon planet is heavenly planet, they're more intelligent than you. If you have got some machine to reach there, they have got some machine to divert you. These rascals are coming here without any immigration license. Let them be diverted to the deserted portion, and disappointed, they'll go back. Because there's only stones and dust. Nothing there. So I thought that was a very interesting statement. Yes, they have a machine, they have technology to divert you to some uninhabited region of the moon. And then you'll just be disappointed and go back. So I think these are the three choices that we have if we're followers of Srila Prabhupada. Because he said all of them. You know, he said sometimes they never went. Sometimes he said they went, but they couldn't get in. Sometimes he said they went and they were diverted to some uninhabited region and they just went back. Well, that's what I said too. Sometimes I said he said they were diverted to another planet, like Rahu also. Yes. So you have to decide, I guess, which version you favor. Of course, they then went many times, and it could be different each time. Sometimes it could have been a hoax. Sometimes it could have been something else. I tend to favor this last explanation. But whatever happened, they never got to the realm of the demigods, the heavenly realm of Chandra, moon god, his associates. Now, one thing we notice about the Vedic universe is it's designed for life. Everything is perfectly arranged for life to exist in the Vedic universe. And even modern astronomers are starting to notice this. They're starting to notice that certain features of our universe are very finely tuned so that life can exist. And that suggests there had to be some kind of cosmic intelligence, you know, behind the whole thing. Of course, we know who that cosmic intelligence was, Krishna. But even the scientists, or many of them, astronomers, are seeing signs that the light, that our universe was intelligently designed. For example, the ratio of the mass of a proton to the mass of an electron has a certain value. The ratio is 1,836 to 1, with a decimal figure there too. If this ratio were even slightly different, according to modern physicists, you would not have stable atoms. Atoms wouldn't stick together. You wouldn't have molecules. If you didn't have molecules, if you didn't have stable atoms, you wouldn't have stars forming. If there were no stars, there'd be no planets, for life to exist on. So, one astronomer, the Royal Astronomer of the United Kingdom, Sir Martin Rees, identified several of these fine tunings of certain ratios of natural forces, certain physical forces. One of them is the ratio of the force of gravity to the force of electromagnetism. The other is the binding energy of the atomic nucleus. The other is a measure of the average density of matter in the universe. Another is the measure of the energy content of empty space. Several physical quantities. And if they were even slightly different, any of these, according to their way of thinking, there wouldn't be a universe. He said these six numbers constitute a recipe for a universe. If any one of them were to be untuned, there would be no stars, no life. So even the modern astronomers are seeing that our universe is very finely tuned for life to exist. In other words, if everything weren't arranged exactly the way it is, there would just be an empty vacuum and no diverse forms of life and complex structures that we actually observe in our universe. Now, even though the universe that we observe appears to be intelligently designed, these astronomers don't like that idea because it suggests the idea of God. And so they're straining their brains to think, how can we avoid this conclusion? Because everything is suggesting that our universe was intelligently designed for life to exist. So the only way they've been able to escape the idea that everything is finely tuned, just like if this man is going to shoot the arrow to hit the target, he has to have everything, just the right tension, the right angle, everything has to be perfect for it to hit the target. So everything in our universe is just, everything is just arranged exactly right for life to exist. So how's that? The obvious conclusion is God made it that way. But they don't like that idea, so they've come up to try to escape that. They propose there's millions of universes, there's an infinite number of universes. And in each one of them, they say, all these forces and ratios they have different values. And we just happen to have won the lottery, so to speak. You know, that's their idea. They call it the, you know, the anthropic principle. You know, you're getting these millions and millions of universes, and we just happen to be in the one, you know, where everything is adjusted. And therefore, well, it shouldn't be any surprise that when we look, everything looks as if, you know, we're designed. But really, it just happened by chance. Now, the problem with that idea is they've never observed any of these other universes, and therefore, they have no way of knowing that in all the other universes there's no life, because that's what they'd have to propose. Now, fortunately, we have a way of knowing what's going on, and we do know from the descending path of knowledge, we do know from Krishna, that there are, in fact, other universes, yes. So they got that right. Yes, there are many universes, but they were all designed for life, and life exists in all of them. So, the scientists got one thing right. Yes, there are many universes. You know, just like I gave the example that even a broken clock is going to be right twice a day. Although we'll be wrong about every other time. So they got that right somehow or other. Yes, there are many universes. What they got wrong is the idea that there's no life in all these other universes. Oh, there it is, the broken clock. So there's some other similarities between the Bhagavatam cosmology and modern astronomy. Most cosmologists today believe that the universe starts out very small and then expands. So they've actually got that right, because from the Srimad Bhagavatam we know that the universes emerge from Mahavishnu in a tiny seed-like state and then expand. You know, as we see here, the universes come out small and then they expand. So, somehow or other, they got that right, that universes expand. Now, they have different ideas what will happen to the universes, you know, once they come into existence. Depending on the amount of matter in the universe, according to them, and its relationship to the force of the expansion, three things could happen. The universe could keep expanding. See, up here is the radius of the universe. So if you're going up, that means the universe is becoming bigger and bigger. This is time. So this is showing that as time goes on, the universes keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. If the amount of matter balances the force of expansion, they believe that at a certain point, the universe will stop expanding and just continue to exist. And then if there's enough matter, they believe that, you know, universes will expand, and then at a certain point they will contract. And actually, they don't know which of those three possibilities is the real truth. But we know, because we have a source of knowledge that tells us. We're like students who have the answers to the exam. Like everybody, every other student sitting there, they, you know, they have the multiple choice questions. They think, is this one right? This one right? But we're like, we've cheated. We've got the answers from the professor. So we know what the answer is. The universes are going to contract. At the end of a lifetime of Brahma, they're going to contract and re-enter the Mahavishnu. Now, another similarity between modern astronomy and the Bhagavad cosmology is that Bohm proposed there was something existing before the material universe or universes. There was something before time and space as we know it. So, for modern astronomy, that something that existed before the universe is what they call a quantum mechanical vacuum. And, you know, they call it the quantum vacuum field. And they compare it to a seething sea of cosmic energy. And little bubbles are coming out of it. They're called virtual particles. Has anybody ever drank a 7-Up? Everybody knows what 7-Up is. Okay. So you pour it into your glass and it starts, you know, like if you put your face near it, you can feel little bubbles coming out and then they go back in. So they think this quantum mechanical vacuum is like that, like a big ocean of 7-Up with lots of little bubbles coming out of it and then immediately disappearing, going back into that ocean. But they say at a certain point, you know, one of these, what they call virtual particles, they exist in forms of matter and antimatter. And they come out, they collide with each other, and they extinguish each other. When you have the matter and the antimatter combined, everything just goes back into the quantum mechanical vacuum. But they say somehow or other, you know, it's like if you have 1,000 people, no, 1,001 people, and then you tell everybody, okay, everybody get a partner, you know, and sit down. There's going to be one person left standing, no partner. So they say that's what our universe is. It's a virtual particle for which there was, it didn't eliminate itself. And then somehow it just started expanding, and that's what our universe is. That's how they explain it. Now, I mean, the problem with that is it really doesn't explain very much. It doesn't explain where consciousness came from. It doesn't explain all the order and complexity, you know, that we see in the universe. So we also say that there was something existing before time and space, something existing, you know, before the material universe, but what we propose existed explains what we observe better than what they propose existed. We propose, yes, there was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a conscious, eternally conscious being. And that explains the order and complexity we observe in the universe. It also explains consciousness. Because we are particles of consciousness. Jivas, they are part and parcel of Krishna. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. You know, we are eternal particles of consciousness that emanated from an eternal conscious being. So what we propose existed before time and space, what we propose existed before the universe, explains what we actually observe in a better way than their quantum mechanical vacuum. And I'll just end with another little story. They even have a hard time explaining the origin of the planets. Once I was in England and I was visiting a devotee who was going to a university in England studying astronomy. and this was in Newcastle, and she invited me to come to the University of Newcastle to sit in on her astronomy class to hear what her professor was saying. So the professor was trying to explain the origin of the planets. Because they now propose that first there was the sun, and then there was a cloud of gas surrounding the sun. And then they say, well, somehow the gas began to clump into little bits of matter. And then some of the little bits of matter began smashing into each other and then sticking into each other, so you get bigger chunks. And then that's how the planets formed. And the professor said, well, there's a problem with that we haven't solved yet. Because when you get big chunks of matter of a certain size, he said, you know, when things are going at a high rate of speed and they're colliding into each other, they don't stick together. They explode. They break into smaller pieces. And so he said, we haven't really figured that out yet. So even the modern astronomers, they haven't really even got a good theory of how planets form. So the main thing we have to understand is that not all features of reality are visible, you know, to the modern materialistic scientists. Fortunately, we have a way of knowing things that are beyond ordinary vision. We just have to take advantage of it. It means accepting the descending path of knowledge, becoming Shastra Chakshush. So the modern materialistic scientists are telescope chakshush, you know, like that, and we're shastra chakshush. But it's not that there's no connection between the two, you know, as I'm trying to show. It's not that they don't know anything at all. They know something, but they don't know the complete truth. And if they want to know the complete truth, they're not going to be able to do it just with telescopes. So I have to take advantage of this other source of knowledge to become Shastra Chakshush. You have to take advantage of the Shabda Pramana. So, thank you for your attention. Does anybody have any question or comments? Yes, okay. Yes, what you say is right. Like you say, ideas are changing. This understanding of the fine-tuning problem, how everything is very fine-tuned, you know, that's helpful. I will say cosmology is not my main field. I was asked to say something about cosmology, so I tried to say a few words, and you know, I said it's a very difficult topic, so I said something about it. But I think you're right that in presentations to scientists, you have to consider very carefully their, you know, mentality, their language, if they want to. If their normal way of discussing these things is in terms of, you know, mathematics, then we have to make mathematical, you know, presentations. I think there are other fields besides, you know, astronomy and astrophysics where it's possible to make presentations about, you know, the Vedic cosmology, you know, cultural anthropology, you know, religious studies, then it may be a different kind of presentation. Because many scholars today, they want to hear about alternative cosmologies and things like that. But I think you're right, if we are presenting these things to astronomers and astrophysicists and cosmologists, you know, then, you know, we should know their language, we should know their methods, we should also know our cosmology, both from the Puranic standpoint and the Jyotish standpoint, as you were saying. And it requires a special kind of intelligence, how to do that, a special kind of determination, but I think if we try as humble servants of our disciplic succession, then Krishna will give the intelligence how to do it. As in your case. You had something to say?
Yes. Yeah. So the Buddha, something was missing in this presentation. I think maybe so the Buddha made a discovery of the previous mathematical proof.
Yes, but in a short presentation, I can't say so many things. Okay. I think he's pointed out some correlations. The correlations aren't mentioned, you know, directly in, you know, the Bhagavatam itself. You know, the Bhagavatam doesn't make the correlation.
But he says measurements. Measurements?
Yes.
They correlate.
Right. From what I can see, the Bhagavatam doesn't make the correlation. It may be there. The question I would have is, like, and it would require like a mathematician, I think, or somebody, you know, who knows statistics, to see if the correlation is a real one or one that could have, that is very likely to be there.
It makes that present.
Yes. So I presented what I understand. like I said, cosmology is not my main field. You know, I'm more at home in. Okay, very good. Something else?
As the young. Mm-hmm. That same ways.
Where is that statement?
Well, I have to find it.
I think that's one of the main points I was making. According to our level of perception, which is governed by, you know, our piety or spiritual advancement, we'll see the universe in a certain way. Yeah, I think that's one of the fundamental things I was trying to get across here. I'm not familiar with the statement, but after many decades where scientists weren't speaking about consciousness, they're now speaking about it again. And some of them have different ideas about what consciousness is. Some of them still think it's just that there's no real thing, consciousness, it's just an aspect of matter. Others, you know, are saying it's some emergent property of matter. You know, if you have matter combined in a certain complex way, consciousness will emerge, and as long as the matter is organized in some complex way, consciousness will continue to exist. And then when the matter disintegrates, disorganizes, then the consciousness also disappears. And then some of them, very few of them now, are actual, what we would call dualists, who believe that consciousness is something separate, you know, from matter. So without studying carefully what the scientists actually had to say, I can't say right now what he was thinking about consciousness, whether it was a property of matter, whether it was some emergent, temporary, emergent property of matter, or whether it's eternally existing.
Something
by
about
itself.
The laser does to the atoms.
That would tend to indicate to me that he's thinking it's a material property, I would say. I mean, just off the top of my head.
There are quite a few limitations about this what we're talking about.
Well, if in Shastra it says that, I would accept it. If we just start speculating about what Shastra means, then Shastra loses all of its authority. It just means whatever we say it means. And then, why have Shastra then? You know, so Like in Chaitanya Charitamrita and his discussions with the Mayavadis, Lord Chaitanya said, we have to take the mukya vritti, the direct meaning of the words, unless there's some indication from Shastra itself that the words aren't meant to be taken directly. The other method is gauna vritti, which means you interpret without reference to the direct meaning of the words. So we have to be careful about these things. Usually, if we're going to be members of a disciplic succession and representatives of the tradition, we're more or less obligated to not just accept the statements, but accept the statements about how statements are to be regarded. So in our tradition, the general method is accept the statements as they are. And, you know, if something is not understandable by the direct meaning, then it's said you can engage in some interpretation. But if we go too far in that direction, then there's no authority left, you know, to Shastra. So my tendency would be to say, if one of our acharyas, recognized acharyas, said something like that, or if a Shastra itself had said something like that, then, well, I would think, okay. And being that I consider myself to be a little insignificant, I don't think I would myself think, well, I'm a great acharya who can make such adjustments beyond myself.
I can properly explain all these things.
Yeah.
So, he's an acharya. What about unlimited intelligence?
Well, like I said in the beginning, this is a very difficult topic. And I'm just, you know, praying to be able to say a few things, helpful things about it. Yes?
I mean, if you take full mandala as a...
Well, I would say it still has to do with perception. You know, these things may be made of elements not exactly like, you know, the ones we're familiar with. You know, just like I mean, the universal form is there somehow, but we're seeing the stars through it, you know. I mean, universal form is there. If we were able to, it includes the whole universe, the universal form. So, if you want to say, oh, it's there, I mean, we shouldn't be able to see anything if it's there, right? So I think perception, it has a lot to do with it. Yeah, just like I gave the example of the X-ray and the optical telescopes. The structures that were visible through the X-ray telescope weren't blocking, you know, the ordinary perception, you know, through the optical, what you would see through an optical telescope. Their structures are there, they're there, and they're visible through, like, the X-ray telescope, but they're not blocking what an astronomer would perceive through an optical telescope. I mean, that's an example. Possible.
Possible.
Yeah, but I guess his question is, shouldn't you see like a big black spot when Krishna's going? Right? Krishna should be blocking.
No, just talking about vehicles.
Yes, well, you're saying they should be blocking the stars.
On one side of the kidney.
Right, you're saying they should. What I'm saying is the structures may be not analogous to that. But like that's like saying if Krishna's there, then you shouldn't be able to see the stars behind them, right? But I think you have to look at all the statements of Shastra, Srila Prabhupada. The way I try to consider that, and this is something you can accept or not accept, because the Shastra we have to accept, you know, Drudakarma's attempt to explain Shastra, you don't have to accept, you know, you can accept or reject. I think, Sadhguru pointed out, there are descriptions in the Mahabharata of stars as being fires. Mm. Arjuna went out to visit them and he saw them. And I think we can use the term reflection in many ways. We can say, like, for example, a son, S-O-N, reflects the qualities of the father. You know, I mean, we can use that word reflect in many different ways. But he says other things too. So he says other things.
According to the
See, another thing. Oh, I'll add another thing. We have to remember that the Vedic cosmology is personal. And with each celestial body, there's a personality associated. Now, the Brahma Samhita says that the sun is like the king of all the celestial bodies. Raja Samasta. What is that? Raja Samasta. Like that. So, there are different personalities associated with all the celestial bodies, the stars, the sun. Now, just like you might have a fleet of ships, you have many ships. One of them is the flagship because that's the one the admiral is on, the commander of the fleet. Now, there may be other commanders. They look just like human beings, and they're commanding the other ships. And the ships may be the same, but the one that the admiral is on is considered the flagship. So I think when you can accept this or reject it, but when I consider all the statements, you know, my best understanding of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu on this question is when we say sun, we mean the star where Surya and Narayan, who's the controller of all the celestial bodies, lives. And that's what it means when we say there's one sun, just like there's one flagship in a fleet. And that's what I mean when we talk about these things. I think we have to consider everything that we know from Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu about these things. We know there are statements in Shastra that says stars have their own light. They're there. We know that each celestial body has a personality connected with it. You know, we know that Surya Narayan is in the sun, and that's why it's the sun. Not that there are no other stars. I mean, there are many descriptions of stars, you know, Taraka, you know, the seven sages, constellations, there are many descriptions, but the one that we're familiar with is the sun is special because that's, you know, it's the king, where the king of all the planets lives. Anyways, that's Now things will be resolved, I'm sure.
I hope.
Yeah. But I'll go back to the statement that Srila Prabhupada made, that he expected his scientifically trained devotees to put statements that he made, you know, in proper terms. And that's a service that he gave, you know, to those devotees. Because he said, there, he said, I may say it in a certain way, and it may seem, you know, but he said, you put it in a way that it can't be refuted easily, you know, by scientists. Yes, that was one of his instructions to, you know, scientifically trained devotees, I think. Well, Srila Prabhupada said that for those who don't accept Shastra and who accept, you know, they don't accept Shabda, they accept Pratyaksha and Anumana, sense perception and logic. So he said sometimes we have to use those methods, you know, to convince people. Because they don't accept Shastra at this moment. But if we can give them good reasons in terms of the kinds of evidence they consider valid, then out of our mercy we'll do that. Like I said, if I want to know something about the universe or archaeology or anything, for me, Shastra is enough. I don't need anything more. Now, if these other scientists, they are not accepting Shastra, then, or the conclusions of Shastra, then, well, out of mercy, we may discuss with them in the terms that they accept. Because we're merciful to them, and we're also concerned about the other people that they're misleading.
Yes.
Well, that's the hope that and it's not something that we just have thought of doing. You know, Srila Prabhupada ordered, you know, that this be done, you know, that we should make presentations to them. So that's one reason why we do it. Because it's the order of our spiritual master to do it. So we can just, on one level, it's possible. I just blindly follow the order of my Guru Maharaj and resolve after Krishna, and I don't even think about it. But on another level, I think they can become interested in Shastra as a source of knowledge that can help guide their research. And they also can become friendly with the devotees. Like, you know, I go to scientific conferences, and a lot of times I have to, you know, I have to socialize with them and, you know, things like that. And then, and although this shouldn't be done very much, I mean, Srila Prabhupada did give allowance for devotees who are meeting with important people to, you know, sometimes eat in restaurants. You know, he said you can order something vegetarian, offer it in your mind. I mean, it's not something I would do if there was any other choice, but sometimes, you know, they start learning. Oh, you know, you don't eat meat. Or they know I get up in the morning and I meditate, chant on my beads, and they ask, you know, what is that meditation? What are you doing? You're talking about these Puranas. Have any of them been translated into English or other languages? And, you know, they... So there's a kind of, like you say, an intellectual aspect to it, but there's also a personal aspect to it. And for example, I gave a paper at the Bhaktivedanta Institute conference that was organized in Rome last year. Of course, there it was very nice because the devotees organized it, so all the food was prasadam, and, you know, like that. And then, you know, so the scientists, they get to taste some prasadam and associate with devotees. And also hear interesting ideas that challenge their way of thinking and, you know, that show that maybe there's some value, you know, to this kind of thing. So we're not trying to be just ordinary jnanis. you know, we're devotees, and we've entered into a certain realm of, you know, preaching with the idea of attracting them to Krishna consciousness. If necessary, I mean, sometimes if they're very demoniac, you know, they're very demoniac scientists, you know, we have to challenge them and defeat their arguments for the benefit of the people in general. You know, Srila Prabhupada said that should have to be done sometimes. But others, we may find they're attracted to our ideas, our philosophy, our way of life. And they can be brought closer and closer to Krishna consciousness. I was at one scientific gathering, and I was talking to one of the scientists there, and I dress in Western clothes, but I always tell people I'm with the Hare Krishna movement and like that. And so he said to me, "Oh, you're with the Hare Krishna movement, but you're not one of the kind that goes in the street chanting like that." And I said, "Well, yes, I do sometimes do that. And it's lots of fun." "Oh, really?" He became very interested. You know, like, or so I think there are many motives, you know, that we would have in doing the kind of thing we're doing. One, it's the order of the spiritual master. Two, they can become attracted. You know, three, sometimes they need to be defeated. And so many, many reasons. There are many hopes. But you're right, ultimately, I was having a discussion about evolution with a scientist. And at the end, you know, he said to me, "Okay, you've created a doubt in my mind about evolution." And he said, "But you've done it using the same methods that you say are so imperfect." In other words, you know, sense evidence, you know, material logic. And I told him, "Now you're beginning to understand that we're really never going to get anywhere by that method." I said, "Fortunately, there's another method. It's called the descending path of knowledge." And then he said to me, "But there's so many descending paths of knowledge, and how do I know yours is the right one?" So I think that's the next part. That's where the discussion goes. You know, with, you know, logic and reason and things like that, we can show them the mistakes that they've been making. We can show that some of the things that the Vedas say are correct. But to go beyond that, you know, they have to take a further step of adopting the descending path, the Vedic descending path of knowledge. And then they'll begin to ask, "Well, what makes your descending path so special?" And then I think that's the next stage of the discussion. And I think we can present why, you know, our Vedic descending path of knowledge is superior.
Question in terms of the stars and their connection.
Well, yes, Srila Prabhupada does use the term reflection in that exact same sense. So that's what why I was saying, I think we have to, when we're talking about these things, if we just take one isolated statement and try to make a judgment based on that, it may be misleading. Because I've pointed that out, you know, the exact same thing that you say. Srila Prabhupada says that the sunlight is a reflection of the Brahmajyoti, and he doesn't mean it, you know, like light
like
bouncing off the mirror. Yeah, I mean, like I said, there are different senses of the word reflection. And if he did say it in a way that seemed to indicate something else, then he also said it was up to his scientifically trained disciples to present it in a proper way that's not easily refuted.
He says, there's only one side of the universe.
Well, if that were the only... If that were the only thing he said, that would be very interesting, but it wasn't. And even if it were, he also said his disciples should take the things that he said and present them in a way that can't easily be refuted, you know, by scientists. Like I said, this is a very difficult area, and I think one methodological principle is we have to look at all the relevant statements from Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu and try to come up with a proper understanding. And I think the proper understanding of that question is one sun means not that there's one star in the universe, but that there's one star that is inhabited by the Lord of all the planets in that universe. So that's what I mean. We have to consider everything because the Vedic universe is a personal universe. Each celestial body has a being associated with it. So I think all these things have to be considered. All right, so thank you. Hare Krishna. Tomorrow, I'll be talking about a Vedic alternative to the theory of evolution. Hare Krishna.